When you sat down to do that article, did you end up having to eject some of the material? You know, what is that process like?
I call it censorship, right? I start out dumping what I really would like to say, and then in the second draft of the text, I just start to take out things just to make it digestible.
So you just start by putting everything down?
Sort of, yeah.
And yeah, and that's a useful way to do that. I sometimes work that. That sort of gets you over that writer's block to put everything down, and then you can take it out at the end. Another way you can do it is to write down the topics you want to cover, A, B, C, D, E, and maybe there's F. And then you say, okay, I've got to make this, in the case of physics today, come in under 4,600 words. And that turns out to be not a whole lot of space. So then you think, well, how much space do I have, say, in terms of paragraphs for each one of these topics? And can I really do them justice? Then you have to have this trade-off between depth versus breadth. And you can make that call any way you want, but I think you have to, it's good to consciously do that. And then, and sometimes you can get away with treating more things if you say, okay, I'm not going to go into the details of this calculation or that calculation. I'm just going to, you know, figure out what are the most important things and just cover them lightly without going into the detail. You just, it's a matter of, you know, are you, it's really a matter of this path. You know, are you going to keep it at a certain level without getting into the details? Then you can say more. And sometimes that organizes the material for the reader better than getting the reader involved in the nitty-gritty details. It's, what you have to do for the reader is pre-digest the material and then, so that they have a place to hang it on. You know, sometimes when I read things on fields that I hear all these terms around, I don't know how to organize it. And if a good article comes along and say, well, this is in this category because of this, and this is in this category because of that, and this category because of that, and then I have slots to put things in. It's like cubby holes. If you can figure out a way to organize your material so that people know where to put their little slots. Okay, so that's their overall thinking about it. Then most articles these days have the following components. A title, what we call a bank. It's like an abstract. But unlike a scientific abstract where it's, you know, the conductivity was measured and the resistivity was determined and everything's passive and you summarize the results. A bank is a, you know, just one or two sentences below the title that elaborates on the title a little bit. And then there's an introduction. And then the body of the text, and the conclusion, and of course, important adjuncts to these are illustrations and references. So let me talk about these first, but I don't. How many of you actually end up writing the beginning first? No, Mike's shaking his head. What do you do?
I always write the introduction last. Once the main body has become clear, and also then the emphasis becomes clear, and you know what you want to, how you want to hook the reader, and bring them at the start. But
yeah.
I think writing starts a hostage to fortune, and you get terribly torn apart when you start writing the main body of the text.
Yeah. Does anyone do it any differently?
I mean, sort of depending. Like when I write a real scientific paper, then I follow the method of introduction last. But they were able to appeal to the general readership. I mean, you have to start out with sort of, you know, nice, sound bites,
sort
of give away more of the story, and then you build the body of the story basically around it, that message in the beginning.
I have a hang up, and I think it's wrong, but I have to get the first paragraph just right. Sometimes the first sentence, and I can have this writer's block for days, and I'll have it back in my mind until I get that first sentence just right, and then the other sort of falls in place. But I think that's only because I can only write the first paragraph once I've mentally organized the rest of it. So whether you do it on paper or mentally, I think it's. You know, it's that process of coming up with the introduction is the process of determining where the article really is going to be. Okay, so what are the things you that a title should have? What are the attributes a title should have? I have some examples that could be.
It should be surprising if you can.
Oh, surprising, that's good, yeah. What should it not be?
Dull.
Dull? How about full of terms you've never seen before? No jargon. Okay. And does it have to give you an idea of what's in the article? It may not have to because you got today you always have this bank below it, if you can elaborate in the bank. So what can you use the bank for? Well, I just said elaboration. I sometimes use it to define terms. That if I find that the only way to come up, well, one thing we inherently, it has to be somewhat short. Sometimes the only way I can come up with a short term in this title is by using a word that may not be known to other people, and then I'll define it sort of indirectly in the bank. So that's, you can use it. Or you could, also you want to summarize. Give the reader an idea, if he reads this article, what's he going to learn, he or she? Okay. Today's introduction, usually, because the title, it used to be, and when I wrote news stories early on, we didn't have the bank. And so, you know, coming out of the newspaper classes, they say, you know, answer the five W's, what, when, why, where, and how. I guess how was an exception to the W, but you're supposed to get it all in the first paragraph. But it's harder these days with physics being so specialized that sometimes you have to spend a couple of paragraphs just to give people the understanding they need to know why something's exciting. You just have to back off. So if you can get them in with little tantalizing tidbits here and sort of promise something, then you can use introduction to be, you know, 3 to 4, maybe more paragraphs that give them the detail. And so what you might want to do in there is to give them some background, as I said, just so that they can understand why this new thing is exciting. You need to tell them where you're going. And it's also helpful to tell them where you're not going, or what you won't cover. If I might use Peter Zoller's example, I by the way, I have some Physics Today magazines here if you want to look at any of them. But Peter's is in the February issue, March issue, and he says in his title he's going to talk about two kinds of quantum information system with ions and cold atoms, and then he mentions at the end of the introduction what he won't be covering, although it's good work, so it's useful to lay that out. Okay, now I'd just like to stop here and get a little more concrete. Is there a little hook to pull the... Does this have a hook on it? Is only the tall people allowed in here? Yeah. So I brought some examples of beginnings of articles, some good and some bad, and hopefully it won't be hard for you to tell the difference. Okay, so here's one that was submitted to us. Actually, we commissioned the article. We very often solicit an article. Okay, this was on climate and sea level rise. The third assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, devotes an entire chapter to the topic changes of sea level. Okay, you're starting to fall asleep. This attention is justified because sea level is both an indicator of climate change and of immense practical importance.
Is this MIMO language?
It's not even good parallel structure. So, long-term beach erosion, a global problem, appears to depend on sea level rise, a comparison of erosion rates and relative sea level rise on the East Beach Coast. Indicates that lateral erosion rates of sandy beaches are more than two orders of magnitude greater than RSL rise. This fact gives even low rates of sea level rise of a few nanometers per year. I think that's supposed to be millimeters. You know, maybe with the new nanoscience funding, they thought they'd get more money for this research. For example, at a popular beach resort community of Ocean City, Maryland, where the RSL rises nearly 4 millimeters per year, about 4 to 5 meters of the beach that is only a few tens of meters wider lost each decade. This loss must be replenished frequently, an expensive undertaking, lest the structures there become vulnerable to. Okay, this is the proposed introductory paragraph. Okay, now it's interesting that the article really does not deal with sea level erosion. It deals with how you measure sea level rise and how you subtract out this effect of this rebound after the weights of the glaciers have been lifted, and then there's a sort of elastic rebound, and that's a big contributor to the apparent sea level rise that you have to correct for. So, you know, so not only is it poor language, too detailed. Starting off with the first sentence of something, you know, nobody knows what this is, and it's heavily weighted with, you know, administrative terms. You're just not going to get anybody to read this article unless they happen to live really close to the beach.
You know, it'd be fine for a technical article addressed to the specific community of sea level rise people. So, I mean, he's.
But even for them, if he's really going to spend the article talking about so the how measurements and the problems of determining what the sea level rise is, I find this a little misleading. I mean, it does raise. I think he thought, well, it will raise their interest by talking about beach erosion rates.
Right.
But I think, too, it hasn't done it very well.
So were you going to save this article, or did this?
The article itself was okay, but it did take a lot of editing. So I actually didn't edit this one, and this is the one that this is the first sentence as it or first few paragraphs as it came. So we gave it the puzzle of global sea level rise. Measuring the rate of sea level rise of the past century requires modeling the behavior of Earth's century. So that gives you an idea that we're going to deal with measurements and we have to look way back. And then it says global sea level rise embodies many aspects of global hydrological cycles and reflects the heat content of oceans because of their density. Global sea level is therefore a potent indicator of climate change and a key observational constraint on climate models.
I don't like an acronym. Why?
What?
The GSL, I find really.
I like to avoid defining any acronym in the first sentence. In the first paragraph, I would defer that.
It's all you can do it, but in the introduction, I just don't like it.
I think it makes it seem more technical. then in the second paragraph, this editor chose to bring in some reasons, some other reasons besides, you know, indicating climate change, of practical importance. So they bring in some of the coastal erosion there, and that's sort of supporting, giving you information at the beginning about motivating your reading it. But then it's not coming right up front to tell you that that's what the article's going to be about.
Well, it's playing here very clearly surprising, right? That it's very catchy.
Yeah.
Basically saying you have to measure 20,000 cubes in order to come up with
anything useful. Right. Okay. So we're doing time-wise. Okay, here's another one. Cost-effective technologies to reduce carbon dioxide emissions in the U.S. by 2010, a physics perspective. I can only read it over here. Reducing heat-trapping greenhouse gases, GHG, emissions that contribute to global climate change is an environmental problem that physicists and those who understand physics can help solve. Carbon dioxide, CO2, is the largest single source of anthropogenic GHG emissions. The U.S. produces nearly a quarter of this carbon dioxide, almost all of which comes from fossil fuel energy, which in turn accounts for 90% of our energy use. As we show in this paper, physicists and those who apply physics, again, have made many advances in energy efficient and low carbon technologies that will be a major factor in reducing climate risks cost effectively. Figure 1 shows the relative contributions weighted according to the global warming potential of CO2 and other GHGs to U.S. GHG emissions in 1990, the base year for climate negotiations. Does anyone know what the base year for climate negotiations means? No, and no one knows what global potential warming is, a global warming potential. It's got a lot of statistics being thrown at us, a lot of acronyms, and then this silly thing of physicists can talk. It's a little sophomoric. So there's, we had to do a job on that. And here's what appeared. We took some of the words out of that title, technologies to reduce carbon dioxide emissions in the next decade. Prospects for meeting the Kyoto Protocol for greenhouse gas reduction will be brighter if the U.S. can develop its technologies to lower its energy use. So in other words, connected, this is going to talk about some of the technologies that can address that. And, this is what, a 4 or 5 page introduction. The first one sort of raises concern.
In there? Reducing CO2 emissions in the next decade is a shorter and equally informative title.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we have technologies here in the bank to show that's the aspect of it. Right, that's a good suggestion. You know, we can always keep going back and edit ourselves to death. No, it's good. In fact, that's a point I'd like to stress. And you sort of implied it when you said, you know, you write out something really long and then you go back and cut. The first draft is just that. That's just the beginning. And the people that I've seen or worked with over the years who don't get better are the ones who never are willing to revise their drafts and really, really take them apart. I mean, Gloria Lepkin sort of trained me in it, Physics Today, and I'd write a paragraph and she'd just write, unclear. Well, thanks. And then I'd say, well, what's unclear about it? And I'd ask myself that because she wasn't specific. And sometimes you can't be specific. Haven't you read something that's so wrong you don't know where to begin? And then if you know it's unclear to somebody, you know, just be honest with yourself and look at it critically. Maybe go away for a day, come back and say, oh yeah, I really have to explain this better. So, you know, just sometimes start all over again. Anyway.
Actually, I don't think technology is bad in the title, because it could be about legislation or taxation or something.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of emissions is a necessary technological thing.
Right.
And that, of course, could immediately turn people off. So the fact that we're just talking about technology rather than legislation and taxation might be possible future.
Yeah, okay. Well, in this one, I just chose to link the global temperature rise with the greenhouse gases, which hadn't been done in that other article. And then dominant among greenhouse gases is carbon dioxide. Even when the gases are compared in terms of their perturbation to the atmosphere, that's my sort of qualitative way of defining this term global warming potential. It's actually just a measure of their effectiveness in causing a warming. This concentration is increased by a third. Then I talk a little bit about the Kyoto Protocol. And here was some details about how much carbon dioxide the U.S. does spew out compared to how much the Kyoto Protocol says they have to reduce it. And so that's a big challenge. So that sort of sets the challenge. Let's look at technologies that might help us meet that. So just... Okay, I'm gonna.
Is this then the actual published article?
Yeah.
Did you just show this?
Yeah, I enlarged the front for the text a little bit. This one I didn't enlarge, so you might have to suffer with it. These are some beginnings that I really liked. So we have some positive examples too. Structured fluids. Okay, I don't know what a structured fluid is. Do you? Fluids containing polyatomic structures, okay, manifest a wide variety of mechanical responses, and they can exhibit numerous forms of self-organization. Okay, so that's kind of intriguing. It sort of tells you what the structured fluids are and what it's going to tell you about them. And then it starts out, water, gasoline, pancakes, or mucus. I mean, I don't think we've ever had mucus in our text before. Corn starch and water paste, da-da-da-da-da, okay. It goes on with a few too many liquids, but they're all clearly liquids. The other substances, strictly speaking, are also liquids since they all flow on the application of stress, but the name liquid hardly captures the variety of behavior in these substances. The substances differ from one another in their mechanical responses almost as much as they differ from solids. So I like that sentence anyway, because it's a parallel structure. And it sort of says what these don't have in common. In the first place, they differ enormously from one another in viscosity, and then it defines viscosity. Furthermore, many of them have striking properties whose description requires variables besides viscosity. Syrup becomes sticky as it dries. Liquid dishwashing soap has the same consistency as syrup, but does not become sticky on drying, and so forth. So I think it's great. It's fun. It relates it to something really, really concrete. And
isn't the first paragraph too long?
Yeah, I think it's too long. Yeah. And I don't know how, I mean, you could break it into two paragraphs. I wonder if you could get by with it, with mentioning a few, somewhat fewer substances and still have the same effect, or maybe a greater effect by having fewer substances mentioned. Yeah. Okay. Another one of my favorites, artificial atoms. Well, because this is Mark Kastner, and he coined this term. And I think it's a great way to look at these quantum dots. So artificial atoms, there's a sort of something tricky. If you hadn't heard the term, and this was an article from, I think, in the early 1990s. The charge and energy of a sufficiently small particle of metal or semiconductor are quantized just like those of an atom. So it defines what right away what you mean by artificial atoms. The current through such a quantum dot or one electron transistor reveals atom-like features in a spectacular way. Okay, so it promises that it's going to show you some neat effects from those atoms. And then I like this word, the wizardry. Wizardry of modern semiconductor technology makes it possible to fabricate particles of metal or pools of electrons in a semiconductor that are only a few hundred angstroms in size. Electrons in these structures can display outstanding behavior, and so on. So in my own mind, I regard all these as artificial atoms, atoms whose effective nuclear charge is controlled by metallic electrodes. Like natural atoms, they have a discrete number of electrons, but they're, you know, they can be manipulated. So I think this sets out the whole article in one paragraph. This is an introductory paragraph that really introduced the whole article, and then it goes on.
I have a negative reaction to the second sentence. Electrons and these structures can display astounding behavior. This, I don't know, there's so much hype.
Overstated.
That really, that kind of threw me off to the article.
Yeah.
I mean, I know what he's trying to convey, his enthusiasm for this.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for a popular article, I think it's okay, these kind of sentences.
But there's always always a tension that you were encouraged to make it exciting and relevant and so forth. But if you overstate it, it's like calling wolf too many times. So I mean, I think that's a big tension in our field increasingly, because I think there's more popularization.
And I think that the previous one didn't need to do that. The structured liquids one didn't tell you were going to be a standard, it convinced you that you were going to be by that.
Yeah.
A much more engaging style somehow than
Right. That's a good point. It's let the material speak for itself if you present it in a concrete enough way.
I mean, there's also this issue, right? It's going into a personal tone in my own mind, if I regard all of them, these as artificial atoms. I find it sort of not so easy myself to figure out when it's the right time to do it. I mean, when you start to write in a personal form, the text becomes often more appealing, right? But at the same time,
it sounds pretentious. I think if you keep that problem in mind, that you want to make it personal, make a direct contact that way without sounding pedantic.
This particular sentence, as you told us, he's inventing a new term. He's a noun in that sentence. What the new term is.
Right.
And by making it personal, he's saying, here's my new term. This is what it means. It'd be hard to do that in a personal way about a phrase that never existed before.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he could have said, one might regard these. He could have said, one might regard these as artificial atoms. But then it doesn't have the same charm. I think you lose some charm that way because you make it a little too impersonal, too formal. In fact, in writing news stories, I would like to be able to say, so-and-so told me. Because I'm reporting to people, and that's what actually happens. Someone tells me something, and I want to quote them. I say, as so-and-so said to me, da-da-da-da-da. And the copy editors, they cut that out because they said, well, you know, I'm supposed to be this impartial, neutral observer, and not supposed to be a participant in the news. But it's obvious, you know, then you have to say, as so-and-so said. And then you say, well, where did he say it? When did he say it? You know, I think it's an artificial distinction there. But I think it's probably better to err on the side of using we or they, we and I. You know, sometimes it's we because you're with the co-author. Then one does, one has. Because that's a very formal language. Okay, so I want to give you an assignment right here. I'm going to have you help me draft a title and a bank for my next search story. Just as examples of titles that I've used in the past that I like. I like to get in a pun if I can. Clouds cast a shadow of doubt on models of Earth's climate. Infrared, well, this one doesn't have a pun, but it was a con of cascade laser, which is a term I didn't want to use in the title. It's a little cumbersome, so I just emphasize it's a new principle of operation. Measured steps, advanced understanding of molecules, it did have an ES on the end. Where they, it's really cool stuff. They use these optical tweezers to measure motor molecules stepping on. They actually measure the step size. So, high TC supercondu, D wave, the new wave. Ozone at the poles, the whole story. Okay. So these are things that I find harder and harder to do these days as I do a more and more complicated story, especially condensed matter. But So let me tell you a bit about a story I'm working on, and I'm still doing a lot of the interviews. I haven't talked to the principals yet, so I'm not sure that, you know, but the story won't take some new twists and turns. But if it were to be a story, only about 2 weeks in experiments, here's what it is. Okay, it's work by a Princeton group and a Caltech group, and I think Eisenstein is going to talk to us a little bit later about it. So he has a quantum Hall bilayer. So already we have one jargon term. Okay, so you have a two-dimensional gas, electron gas here, and another one here, and they're closely spaced. D is very small. And you have a magnetic field on it, make it a quantum Hall system. And what they find, well, I had already reported on a finding where if you get these electrons close enough, they behave collectively. So that, for example, if you have electrons in the upper layer that are in these positions, you won't have an electron directly below there. You'll have one here maybe, but nothing directly above that. And you'll have a hole here, an electron here. And actually, I'm going to put these lines through because what you effectively have is the flux lines pass through each electron. And all these electrons think they're in one layer. They're separated. But there's a high probability of tunneling between them. It's a collective behavior. And it's really uncertain, actually, which layer they're in. So that's why you get them this way. So this is, these are like exceptons then. And they've been trying to get proof that these excitons not only exist in this way, but condense, Bose condense. So they've been looking for a superfluid behavior, you know, superflow of these things. So what they did is put a electric field in opposite directions on the two layers so that they run a current in one direction through the top layer and in another direction through the bottom layer. Okay, so the electrons would be moving, I'm taking the electrons might move in this direction in that layer and in the opposite direction in the bottom layer, but that's the same as having a hole move to the right. Okay, so you should be able to have holes and electrons moving to the left. And if it's a superfluid, you'd expect current flow with no resistance. Okay? So that's what they find. They find that the resistivity in both the longitudinal and the Hall direction is zero. Okay, so there's two experiments that did that. Okay, give me a title. Okay, now let me say one uncertainty I have is that one of the two preprints I have, and I have to ask the people about this, one does not claim to see a Bose exciton condensation. It just reports the observation that they see no Hall resistance. The other one said it's evidence for a Bose condensate.
Who said that? Eisenstein?
Eisenstein. So I have to get on, I have to be asking people what do they think. How great is the consensus that this is a demonstration of Bose condensate? So I'd like a title that, you know, if there's some consensus, that indicates nevertheless some uncertainty. I mean, I could.
Is this a Search and discovery, yes.
Discovery, yeah. So, I mean, you could say, okay, Bose condensation of excitons seen in a quantum Hall bilayer, okay? That would be a really bad title. So we might start by, you know, what goes out. Or maybe you guys want to just think about it for...
Do you have a question mark, another question mark at the end for this title? If you have a question mark, then it makes it like, then this is...
Oh, yeah. I can have a question mark there to indicate the uncertainty rather than doing it with words.
Do excitons both exist?
What?
Do excitons both exist?
It has to be quantum powered by the layer. It has to be for this particular system.
What does that have to be in the title?
Oh, it doesn't. Well, but then you have to convey that is the for this particular system. This is a very special system, and the let's see.
So it becomes
At a more general level, isn't the point somehow whether dissipationless currents and by condensation? And okay, it's a more specific question in this particular case, but if you wanted to engage a general reader, say from particle physics or astrophysics, mm-hmm. you probably wouldn't mention it on the more bilayer.
Do they know that they have excitons? Is that established?
Do they know that they have excitons?
The Eisenstein's exciton is the way that he wanted to recast the theory and interpret mm-hmm. that degrees of freedom as an exciton. And it is the same as everybody uses, but it's a language he chooses to use. And whether it is,
The answer to your question is I don't know that they have direct proof, and I don't know what direct proof would be that you have excitons in that system. I don't know how you would prove that they're there. I don't know how you prove it in a semiconductor. Does anyone know?
But spectrum. You can
combine. For the recombination.
Here, you don't.
But they can't recombine here.
No.
Yeah, so it may just be a construct. So.
The quantum Hall bilayer is charging, but it's essential in some senses that it's two dimensional. That's not so much jargon.
Okay, so that's good. You think about what is the essential thing, and one is the two-dimensional layers.
I remember. Hall is not jargon, right? Everybody knows it. At least physicists know it. The bilayer makes it more jargon. And you can basically say seen in the quantum mm-hmm. Hall system or something. Quantum bilayer.
Yeah. Okay, but okay, you're saying no.
Yeah, but this is for physics.
There's biophysicists. What do you think?
I was thinking, you know, geophysicists, biophysicists. I don't think that a lot of those terms, I think a lot of those terms are jargons. Quantum Hall, excitons, Bose condensation.
Is there some other
way that you can phrase those terms so that for a more general audience
mm-hmm.
of physicists?
Yeah.
I would say that physicists should know.
Okay. There's a separate question. But there's a separate question about whether we know it and whether it contributes to encourage us to read the article. I mean, frankly, I would definitely not use these. Because that's gonna. I mean, maybe people know it. They've heard of it, but they're not going to get any insight. They're not going to want to read this thing if they quantum Hall. I sort of remember what that is. I'm not sure. I won't read this.
How about exciton condensation in quantum Hall systems? Question mark.
Well, so I'm going to just nix this. Okay, and what you have is a bank where you can. Maybe say in words that deal with like two layers of electrons. I was thinking about something like electrons and holes paired across, or
I guess maybe ultimately they would make any difference, but just the title itself would would somehow convey me to the, I would have thought that it must be about semiconductors, usually without magnetic fields. And so,
but how important is that at the beginning? I have to check this out too, but it may be the first.
Yeah, I say that it may be doing the game difference.
Right? It may be the first, the strongest evidence so far for excitons in any kind of exciton condensation in any kind of system, including semiconductors. In that case, and I have to check that out. But let's suppose for the moment that it is. Then this qualification doesn't matter. This alone is exciting, right?
So the title has to include electrons, holes, 2D, and some fluidity.
I don't know if it has to include 2D.
No.
Semiconductor
nanostructures.
Mm-hmm. Well, condensation
is interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, semiconductor nanostructure will not make a particle physicist pulse rays.
Now, to what extent is this same organization of excitons something which appeals to a very general physics audience? I mean, I perceive it to an extent also as sort of a, you know, thing which has been bothering the specialists for a long time. Yeah. This is sort of long-standing dream.
But you also have
the effable in knowledge what excitons is.
No.
In general, it could be just both condensations dries again,
Okay.
Or both polarization of electrical
pairs. I like both condensation strikes again.
Both polarization is fine. That's something everybody knows.
Both condensation strikes again.
Because
we've had reason in quick succession the cold atom BEC and then molecule BEC and then we got fermion BEC and you know we've had a lot of titles about this.
Well,
maybe
this
would be good.
I was inspired by these letters outside. The corridor say, "Big Bob strikes again." Sometimes it's right.
Well, the one I had in mind was excitons join or might join. I'd have to hedge this somehow because I'm not sure how strong I can assert this. Join the club of Bose condensates. So it recognizes that there are other that's a club. Maybe I could say growing club or something.
The layer feature isn't how important because excitons in the bulk of semiconductors is still a major issue as far as I can tell. And excitons in the bulk of semiconductors.
Yeah.
So the fact that it is a bilayer structure should be somehow said, otherwise people
may... Well, would it be sufficient to say it in the bank, where you could say pairs of, you know, in a special system maybe, in, or at least in a two-dimensional system. A 2D system. Pairs of holes. And electrons. And then I might, instead of repeating those, kind of say something exhibit superflow.
I think there's a kind of general question that comes up with some of the points people are making.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the condensed matter things that are in the search and discovery, bit, are there many people apart from condensed matter people that actually read those?
That's a question for you to answer.
Whether it's condensed by the people who are not quite in the field to read them, or whether people genuinely feel better in the field actually do read them. Because whether you start putting in more detailed things, well, partly depends on which.
Yeah, I mean, our objective is to try to reach, you know, provide something that will appeal and be read by the whole community. But we have a superstring theorist over here, and would you read something with this title?
I'm not sure.
I'm actually 2 years behind on reading Physics Today. I've got a big pile of them. You know, it's tough to find the time. I mean, you just think through I just try to catch an essence of what's in the article. I rarely read these from beginning to end.
Yeah.
Surely you would read
either of those. Either of those would catch my interest. I have a physics question, but I think it's probably not appropriate right now.
Oh.
I'll ask you later.
Oh, okay. Fine.
I guess I surely would read the teacher's title and it would be in 6 years. I would surely read sort of the introductory paragraph. Mm-hmm. I get an idea of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, maybe we've beaten this horse to death, huh?
I just wanted to suggest a different approach to this. Right?
Yeah.
You know, you're kind of grouping excitons into this class of all these different Bose-Kalman sets.
Yeah.
But another way to think about it is the Kalman-Hall effect has had all these phases.
Yeah.
Now you could say something like superfluidity joins the
Hall
zoom or something
like
that.
Yeah, okay. Come at from a different point of view, that this is yet another interesting aspect of a quantum Hall system rather than this is another Bose condensate.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel like you've had too much Bose condensate.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay, well, we'll go on. I don't have too much time left, but I just thought I'd walk you through an article. I sort of spent more time on this introductory thing because I think setting the tone and getting it sort of right up front is going to help you think through the whole article. Also, it's awfully hard to analyze an entire article as a group because you'd have to read it first. I did in our guidelines we say that one of our model articles is one on Rick that appeared not too long ago. I brought some copies of it. It's really well done. And let me just put up a few of the slides for it, why tell you why I like this particular article. If you want to start some around here. I had heard a lot of stuff, a lot of terms kicked around about rapidity and jets and high transverse momentum jets and superfluid behavior, and I, you know, sort of my eyes would glaze over. But these two authors do a really good job of organizing things and keeping the jargon out. They have a general introduction which just sort of says, okay, we have some really exciting results after 3 years of operating this accelerator. And it says we used to, you know, it sort of takes you through the history of thinking about elementary particles as nucleons and electrons. And, you know, now we have quark and gluon and we're trying to find out about this, new state of matter, quarks and gluons. And the scrutiny of this new state of matter promises to answer some of the key questions. And then it gives a background of other accelerators and how far they came along. And some of the things it does in the details, I think, are important. In explaining, these earlier accelerators were largely fixed target accelerators where, you know, the beam just hits a target. And says, for fixed targets, as distinguished from colliding beams, the center mass energy grows only as the square root of the beam energy. So it sort of tells in one sentence what advantage the colliders have. Okay, so it gives some history of what was measured before and sets the stage for what he's going to say. Okay, so then he doesn't spend too much time, or they don't spend too much time, on the machine itself, because that's probably not important. I mean, you could probably spend several paragraphs on how the machine was designed and how it's working and so forth. But it's really not relevant. You really want to focus on what are we learning from these collisions. And then it has this nice paragraph here where it gives you the sequence events once these two nucleons collide with each other. You know, it says, okay, first there's this a lot of heat and energy, and then it's mostly quarks and antiquarks and gluons, and then it expands and the particles start to condense out and you end up with hadrons coming out at the end. So it sort of sets the stage of, you know, what's happening in this inside the reaction. Okay, then over the next, oh, and it has this nice visual, because it's going to make the point of how many particles come out of there. And it's thousands of particles, but, you know, you look at that mess and you say, you know, I'd rather do superstrings. Then it takes some of the complicated topics like rapidity and it puts it in a box. And the text of this article never mentions the term rapidity. Doesn't have to. You know, everything, it sort of defines it. You can't see it in the black and white view graphs here too well, but this is a shaded box. It has a nice diagram to show you, you know, where the small rapidity things are, particles are, and the large ones. And then it shows you a graph and says, makes a point that at zero rapidity, you're mostly seeing pions and kaons, the new particles created in the collision. And it's a way to separate out the hadrons that didn't participate in the collisions. So it separates that out, tells you what it is, but it doesn't get bogged down. So boxes are a really useful thing, and so are these simple little diagrams. Whenever you can, think of a way to take something physically difficult and put it in a nice little box. Okay. Here's another nice little illustration for showing off-center collisions and the fact that if you have collective behavior of the particles in here, then because it's off collision, off center, you're going to have a elliptical shape, and it will maintain that shape if there's a lot of strong interactions among the particles, constituent particles, and that's in fact what they see. So that they stress that this main result with this diagram and with this text that repeats a number of times, that's already strong evidence for a thermally equilibrated, more direct evidence that the matter in this high energy extended nuclear state interacts collectively comes from a surprising early Rick result, unexpectedly large effect attributed to a phenomenon called flow. So this picture shows you what flow is, and so does the next paragraph. And then there's several subsequent wording here that says that stresses that what you're seeing is strong interactions. The observation of flow tells us that the Rick collisions produce matter that interacts strongly with itself. So there's repetition that's a useful technique in stressing the points you want to make. Okay. And here's another illustration that's illustrating another key point. And you want to take your article and look through it and make sure that the key points in your article get illustrated. That's a good way of emphasizing them. And a lot of people will just skim the figures, and they're going to learn a lot from the figures even if they don't read the article. Okay, so this has to do with the fact that if you produce jets, they come from collisions of quarks with one another, and you expect them to come at high transverse momentum. But for some reason, they're suppressed compared to what they would be in a regular nuclear experiment. And there's suspicion that the quark gluon plasma is absorbing those particles and not letting those jets get out. So this is emphasized both in the figure and in the text. And the other thing that the text does, it says, well, maybe that interpretation of jet quenching isn't right. And it says, gives the argument why it might not be right. But then it counters with some other evidence. But it sort of leaves you, you know, it's honest about the yes on the one hand and then on the other hand. And it's good to be honest and not just oversell, not always just make the case in one direction. Okay. Now we're getting low on time. I just thought we didn't talk about conclusions, and I just say a word about that. And conclusion doesn't have to be a conclusion. In fact, it's deadly if you call it a conclusion and say, you know, we have just learned that. It's a better way to sort of tie loose ends. You can use it for a lot of different purposes depending on the nature of your article. Tie loose ends, look to the future, you know, what are we going to learn from here on out. This one from this Rick article sort of summarizes, recaps. It says we've already gotten convincing evidence that high energy collisions of heavy nuclei produce a primate hot dense state of hadrons characterized by strong collective interaction. And it shows a theoretical interpretation. Rick has begun to explore a regime in which this thermalized matter is created at densities so high relevant degrees of freedom must be quarks and gluons. This is all summarizing. But then it's looking at the next steps, which is appropriate because this is an accelerator that's going to continue to take data. So this is a nice summary and looking to the future. But you don't have to do that. You may just tie loose ends together, or sometimes, you know, you don't have to have a conclusion. It took me years to learn that. I used to come up with the wimpiest little sentences at the very end until somebody says, you know. Yeah. Okay, a word about references. Let's get the Rick one back. This is our most unpopular rule. We don't like any more than 18 references. And that's sometimes really hard. I mean, in a piece for Physical Review Letters, it's really appropriate. It's inappropriate not to mention all the relevant work. But how many of your readers are really going to go look up all those references, especially for some of the minor points that you make? I think it's still 18. Would?
Well,
no more than 18. I don't know. I mean, yeah, you think it should be modulo 5 or something, right?
You could choose. You can cache any references into each one of them. So that's really 180.
Well, the best thing to do is to find a good review that mentions a lot of the work that you'd want to reference yourself. So if you have a good review, you want to provide a path so that the reader, if the reader chose, he or she could follow that line of references, probably no more than two layers to everything. But, you know, you clearly want to give credit to the main people who have done relevant work that led you to where you are to make that, do that paper. Or most of the time you're writing a review article if you're writing for a general press. I think the other review articles are probably the more helpful ones. Okay. Are there any other questions or things you want?
How many equations?
Well, some people would say none. Equations, I mean, sometimes you can't do without an equation. Some equations, I mean, you have to build your whole article around an equation, right? But you should never put an equation that just, a really technical equation, and just define the terms. I think you should walk people through what these terms mean physically.
Sometimes it saves space.
Yeah, but you still should walk it through it. I mean, you want to put it in there because you want people to know, say, how things vary with other things.
Do you have length limitation?
4,600 words. Yes. What?
Yeah, Scientific American, which is supposed to be even more popular, I mean, for a broader audience.
Yeah.
I mean, equations are forbidden, and sometimes it makes such a mess trying to explain what is in an equation without showing the equation.
They don't make any exceptions, no equations whatsoever?
As far as I can tell, they don't. In teaching, it's optional. So I think for an educated readership, to put two equations is okay.
Yeah, well, sometimes it's silly to write it out in words when the equation, because people are going to remember, especially if it's a simpler one, to see that relationship. And sometimes, like particle reactions, like some of our CP violation articles where you have k-ons and k-zeros and so forth, and it's just easier to see it as an equation. But it's got to be supported by, you know, a lot of texts that people understand. You don't want to have people follow a calculation. You want to set up maybe the beginning equation, say what you come out with, and then make an observation based on that outcome. I mean, if you're just going to have the outcome sit there, I wouldn't bother with it. But you're presumably going to use the equation if you're going to put it down. Well, we've had some really complex. There's one historical one about the development of quantum mechanics that necessarily had to follow sort of the change of equation of viewpoints as the time went on. Yeah. Probably, you know, the overall thing is just keep in mind that reader who's busy and not in your field, and you really want to, you know, spoon feed that person and make it as easy as possible for him or her to come along. Yeah. Okay. Okay, thank you.